Welcome all of you back. I think we're all back now from the Feast of Tabernacles. And I don't think that we have anyone still lingering abroad. Well, as we talked before, it was a great feast for all. And I think this feast is going to be buzzing around for quite some time for many of us. And I hope so, because it will keep us focused on our journey. Now, it's kind of interesting that Mr. Faulkner introduced that song, because one of the things that I want to go back and remind us of, and that is the fact that the Passover is the next holy day coming up. And realizing that, we talked about this year, we talked about how God is looking at our hearts. He looks at our hearts. He looks at the things that we kind of hide, or we try to hide from Him, and He looks for the things that we hide from each other. You know, when we get up in the mornings on the Sabbath to prepare ourselves to come before God's people, you know, we try to put on our very best. I know during the feast, the mornings that I had risen up, I was not doing well at all, but by the time I hit that elevator, I prepared that smile, so the first person I saw didn't know that this dude's in trouble. And you know, and we do that. We do that. We want to put forth our best look, our best effort. We don't want people worrying about us. And yet, sometimes we should allow people to worry about us, because they will bring us into the awareness of the things that we need to do ourselves. And so yet, realizing that the Passover is the next holy day coming up, I have started what I call a series of messages. And the series of messages that I'm working on and will continue to work on is called Moving God's People Closer to God's Kingdom. Everything that I will be sharing as I am afforded the opportunity to speak before you is going to be about moving God's people closer to God's kingdom. And those series of messages will reflect just that. How do we move closer to God's kingdom every day? Like I said, we had a wonderful Feast of Tabernacles. How do we keep that feast alive and the lessons that we have learned moving forward? How do we do that? We have to stay focused. We have to stay focused. We have to become like iron sharpening iron. We've got to keep each other focused and held accountable to doing what God has, as God intends and expects us to do. I was reading an article a while back. This article was published January 3rd, 2018, by John Kurosky. The article is about a man by the name of Ernie Chambers. That name ring a bell to any of you? It didn't ring a bell. It didn't ring a bell to me either. Mr. Ernie Chambers made the newspapers. He also made the news on national television because of something that he did back in August of 2008. And I'll read this article to you, and I'm going to tell you how we probably should react to this article. Now, put your seatbelts on and hold her steady, because I think you're going to find this quite interesting. In August of 2008, Nebraska Judge Marlon Pote presided over a matter brought before his courtroom on that day. The lawsuit of the state senator Ernie Chambers was versus God. Mr. Chambers, in August of 2008, took God to court. How many of you heard about this? Oh, okay. The year before, this citing the Almighty role in fearsome floods, horrendous hurricanes, terrifying tornadoes, widespread death, destruction, terrorism of millions upon millions of earth inhabitants, this senator wanted to go and sue God. And so he filed this lawsuit against God. And Judge Marlon Polk, when he brought it to his attention, dismissed it immediately. Now, Mr. Chambers came back at the judge and said, he countered by saying, the court itself acknowledges the existence of God. Judge Marlon Polk said, God must be served. And if God has an address and you can serve God, then he will hear the case. Judge Polk held up the traditions and the duties of his office when it comes to having someone sued. The individual must be notified. He must receive a writ showing that he or she is being served. Mr. Chambers said, God himself acknowledges, this court acknowledges the existence of God, and a consequent of that acknowledgement is a recognition of God's omniscience. Since God knows everything, God is quite aware of this lawsuit, he says. So Mr. Chambers feels that God is aware of the fact that he is suing him, so God himself should show up in court. I told you to hold on. Nevertheless, Judge Polk dismissed the suit, and the matter came to an end. Of course, the law school graduate and long-serving state senator, Mr. Chambers, didn't actually seek to win the lawsuit against God in court. He had other things on his mind, the article says. Chambers' true goal, he said, was to protest any legislative efforts designated to restrict the filings of a so-called frivolous lawsuit and preserve the openness of the court to anyone, rich or poor, who wants to file suit against anyone. The Constitution requires that the courthouse doors be open, so you cannot prohibit the filing of suits, Chambers said. Anyone can sue anyone they choose, even God. However, other contemporary reports from CBS News and the Washington Post suggest that Mr. Chambers' motives were just the opposite. He sought to protest the filings of frivolous lawsuits by filing an ultimate frivolous lawsuit against God. Whatever Chambers' true motives, CBS reporters and Washington Post reporters denoted, they are aware of the fact that Mr. Chambers skips morning prayers during every legislative session, and often Mr. Chambers criticizes Christians. He criticizes Christians. Perhaps there's more to this quote-unquote frivolous lawsuit, they said, than Mr. Chambers want others to believe. So behind his motive, he continued to push his lawsuit forward. And this went on for a year. He was determined to get God in the courtroom. And each judge that Mr. Chambers went before told him the same thing. If you can serve God, if you can show us his address, and that he has been properly served, then you may continue with this lawsuit. Now, the first thing in your minds, I look at each one of you, you think, how ridiculous. You know, how nuts is this? First thing I thought about was, how much money of this state of Nebraska was wasted on this man's efforts to go and to sue God? Now, why would you go and sue God? What was the purpose? It goes on to say that in 2009, the judge finally, without prejudice, dismissed Mr. Chambers' efforts even to move forward with any lawsuits against God. Now, the interesting thing about this is, when I saw this article, I looked And there were other articles. I mean, there were other articles about people who took God to court. Didn't know there was such a thing, and you know, you could do that. How do you take God to court? And what do you hope to gain if you take God to court? Now, this particular situation was duly noted because of the fact that this man was a senator. And this man decided he wanted to sue God for all the calamities that this world has seen since his time began. He holds God accountable, and he wants to hold God accountable, and he wants the world to know that he is holding God accountable for all of these events. There was one other lawsuit that was shared. I don't know if you remember this one, because I don't either. February 23rd in 2000, it was recorded and published in the New York newspaper. New York attorneys had filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of the children of Israel, the Israelites, a suit against God for a breach of a religious covenant between them and God. And they are the chosen people. And so they are seeking from God $4.2 trillion in punitive and compensatory damages. Wow. Interesting. This really kind of struck my curiosity to go a little bit further to see just how people think when it comes to God. Now, I'd like to read another article to you. This article was written by Julie Exline. The article that she wrote was "Angry at God. If so, you are not alone." You're not alone. The notion of being angry with God goes back to ancient days. Such personal struggles are not new. But Case Western Reserve University psychologist Julie Exline began looking at anger at God in any and every way. Many people experience anger towards God, Exline explains. Even people who deeply love and respect God can become angry with God. You know what? I agree with that. I agree with her statement. People can become angry with God. We ourselves, if we would truly admit it, and if we would truly own the fact that there were moments that we were angry with God, we would share the same sentiments here. Just as people come upset and angry with others, including loved ones, they can also become angry with God. Exline, an associate professor in Case Western Reserve's College of Arts and Science, has researched anger towards God over the past decade, conducting studies with hundreds of people, including college students, cancer survivors, and grief-stricken family members. She and her colleagues reported their results in this article, "Anger Towards God." Anger towards God often coincides with death, illnesses, accidents of natural disaster. Yet anger is not limited to traumatic situations. It can also surface when people experience personal disappointments, failures, or other interpersonal hurts. Some people see God as ultimately responsible for such events, and they become angry when they see God's intentions as cruel and uncaring. They might think that God abandoned them, betrayed them, or mistreated them, Exline says. Exline also notes that it can be difficult for people to acknowledge their anger towards God. Now, I'm not asking for a show of hands. How many of you, myself included, would admit that at some point in our lives, we were angry with God? We were angry at God. Maybe God didn't answer our prayers, or maybe God didn't do what we wanted him to do, and so therefore we felt like he let us down. Many people are ashamed and don't want to admit their feelings, he says. In particular, people who are highly religious may believe that they should focus only on the positive sides of God and not the negative. But religion and spirituality are like other domains of life, such as work, relationships, benefits of caring for one another, difficulties experienced, and anger with God is one of those struggles also, she notes and adds. During her research, she began to notice that it was more difficult for those Christians who believe in God, who trust in God, to admit their anger with God. Overcoming anger at God, she says, may require some of the same steps needed to resolve anger issues with others. People may benefit from reflecting more closely on the situation and how they see God's role in their lives. X-Line suggests, for example, they may become less angry if they decided that God was not actually responsible for the upsetting events in their lives, or if they can see how God has brought some meaning or benefit from a painful situation. People who feel angry towards God also need to be reassured that they are not alone. Misery loves company. You know, we're sitting at the table and you say, hey, you know what? I was upset with God the other day. You know what? Me too. You know, misery loves company. She suggests that people should try to be open and honest with God. I find this interesting about their anger. And I agree. Rather than pulling away or trying to cover up their negative feelings. She brought us some very good points. She brought us some very good points, family, in which I feel and I believe and I see within the church. This past feast, I saw a lot of hurt. I listened to people who have not been around for a long time. I listened to some of their stories. And they were hurt. They were hurt and angry with church members, ministers, family members. They were hurt. And so, because God brought us all together, of course, ultimately, God gets to blame. But yet God allows us to go through these moments so that we can see and learn for ourselves what is really going on in your lives and what he is trying to do in our lives. I have a question for all of us. I already asked myself that question. I never asked you a question I have not asked myself, the same question. Do people have a right to be angry with God? I have three questions I want to ask us. The second one, how does God feel about people being angry with him? And what will our teaching methods be in the future for those like Ernie Chambers, the children of Israel who bonded together to file a $4.2 trillion lawsuit against God? What will your teaching methods be? How will we, family, help them? How will we help them overcome, and how will we help them to be able to see God as God is? So we have work to do. This past Passover, the instructions for all of us were to search our hearts, because God is going to go there and he is going to search our hearts. And when God goes to search our hearts, he's looking for those things, again, as I remind us, the things that we try to hide from others and yet we also try to hide from him. It took me 10 years to realize, standing over my mother's grave, that I was angry for 10 years. I was disappointed that God allowed her to die. But I didn't realize that until one day, just standing over a grave, and just all came out. Wow. And I've been kind of holding that for a long time. Why? Suppress it. Being a man, not sharing those feelings, not wanting to admit the hurt that I felt, not wanting to admit that I felt like, you know, my prayers were not being answered for you to just allow her to die. And yet she prepared me for her death, and so did God. Years later, there was another struggle that I wasn't ready for. And that was something that was done that harmed one of my children. And I kept trying to understand, how and why would God let this happen? When you're doing things right, we feel and believe, why would God let this happen? And what am I supposed to do with this? And how am I supposed to feel? And how am I supposed to go back and trust you again with the care of my family? And it took a few years for that to surface, where I had been suppressing that within my heart. And I say this to you openly and honestly. And so when I speak on the subject about our anger with God, the title for this message this morning, in this series of drawing closer to the kingdom of God, the title is, Let Us Own Our Anger with God. Don't suppress it. Let's own it. And when we own it, now we have to do something about it. We have to do something about it. Did I have a right to be angry with God? That was the first question that I had posed. Do I have a right to be angry with God? Well, God doesn't have a problem with us being angry. God has a problem with what we do with that anger. You know, the Guinness Book of World Records show that the Bible is still the number one best-selling book of all times. I find that interesting when you look at the world out here, to know that there are more than 5 billion copies of the Bible out here in the hands of billions of people. The Bible is still, and this was recorded back in 1995. The only other book that comes close to that, hold your seats, put your seatbelt back on. The only other book that comes close to the Bible is Harry Potter, the book titled The Philosopher's Stone. This book sold over 120 million copies. Harry Potter. How can you compare Harry Potter to God or the Bible? But it's the next number one bestseller. And that book has been printed in over 80 different languages. Wow. Who would have guessed? I would have guessed something else, but Harry Potter? Seriously? Is it okay, family, to be angry with God? Is the first question. Answer is found in Ephesians 4 and verse 25. Ephesians 4 and verse 25. We are told in verse 25, therefore, putting away lying. You see, if we're angry with God, we have to own it. So the first thing that we see here in verse 25 is putting away lying. Let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, even as I have just done with you. I shared just two situations where I found myself angry with God. It took me a long time to admit that I was angry with God. It took me a long time to admit to myself that I was angry, and even longer to admit to God that I was angry. Verse 26, he says, be angry. Paul says, it's okay to be angry, but don't sin. Don't sin. If Mr. Chambers was upset with God, and if these children of Israel, if these Israelites in New York were upset with God, God's okay with that. But don't sin. They have sinned. We, family, have to own the anger within us and be able to move forward so that we can teach billions of people later. Stop and think about this for a moment. I laid back in my chair and I was looking out the window and I was just kind of thinking. Think about all the people who have died over the years. Think about the people who had horrible deaths. Think about the Christians that were on those airplanes in 9/11 that fell from the sky or fell out of the buildings. They had faith, they had belief, they trusted in God, and look what happened to them. What do you think their thoughts are going to be when they're resurrected? The last thought they're going to remember is something probably bashing their head in, or their body's hitting the ground. What do you think their thoughts are going to be? Do you think that they may come up and be angry with God? Do you think they're going to want God to explain to them how and why he allowed this to happen? Do you think that they're going to be asking the questions about their families and how their families had to suffer without them because God allowed this tragedy to happen? What are we going to tell them? How are we going to guide and direct them? How are we, as spirit beings, going to comfort them? We are learning today for ourselves how to take ownership of our own true feelings. And I hope that we are. And as we take ownership of our own true feelings, we will help them to learn to do the same thing. But we're going to have to do a lot of listening, because these are going to be some pretty widespread stories that we're going to hear. Now, Mr. Chambers said that God knows everything. Do you think God knows about this lawsuit that was filed against him in the Nebraska court? Of course he does. Why didn't God react to it? Why didn't God strike him down? Why did God cause something terrible to happen to this man? This man actually flourished after all of this. And his article, I think one of the reasons why I saw it, was just updated just 2 months ago. And this happened back in 2008, 2009. Why are you still putting this out here? Who is the administrator behind this? Who is the orchestrator? And why should this get any precedent today, even before you and me, on God's holy Sabbath day? Well, family, we have a history. Mr. Chambers is not the first person that has been angry with God. How does God feel about us being angry with him? James 4 and verse 6. How's God feel about it? We're going to take a look at three areas with Job. But before we do that, let's go to James 4, verse 6 through 10. God gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud. And so in our evaluation of those that we may have the opportunity to work with who are angry with God, are they proud? Are they arrogant? I find Mr. Chambers very arrogant in his, I want to call it, frivolous lawsuit against God. He's very arrogant. He says, God gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit yourselves to God, resist the devil. Why? Because the adversary wants to feed on that anger. The adversary wants to separate mankind from God. We have to see that in our own personal lives today. What is the enemy doing behind the scene? He does not want us having that relationship with Jesus Christ and God the Father. And so if we allow him that one little spot in our heart to flourish and to separate us from God or distance us from God, then that's what he's going to do. But God tells you and me, submit to God. Resist the devil and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. And so even in a marriage, a relationship, if one spouse is having issues with the other spouse, who do you go to? Go to the bar, talk to your buddies, go to the hair salon, talk to the girls. That's what the world does. What we're supposed to do, God says, if we have a problem with one another, what are we supposed to do? Go to each other. For what purpose? To be reconciled back to each other. And if that is not working, then what is the next step? Well, one of the things that Shell and I used to always tell ourselves and remind ourselves of this, if we are behind closed doors and we have an issue with each other, there's three beings in that room. Me, her, and God. And I'm always reminded, you know, God's listening. And then there's another being in that room. It's called our adversary. And he is listening. And what is his purpose? To destroy. To destroy. So in this process, verse 8, we are to draw near to God and he will draw near to us. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. God wants to be able to lift you up and me up. But we have to own what is true within ourselves. We've got to own it. And we have to let God know, hey, I've been carrying this around for a long time. And you and I got to sit down and talk about this. And I need to sit down and talk to you about this. I need you to comfort me. I need you to help me. And this is what we have to cry out to God and say. We have to humble ourselves. In the article that I read about this senator in Nebraska had nothing to do with humility. Those Israelites that hired the New York lawyers had nothing to do with humility. But God says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. And so if we have a problem with God, humble ourselves before him. Sit down and talk to him. Let's take a look at Job. We know the story about Job, but let's go back and let's take a look. And let's kind of pick apart a few chapters here in Job. Starting in Job 1. You see, we have to keep remembering every day of our lives that the adversary, if we give him place, if we give him an opportunity, if we give him a little open space. You know, remember the example I shared with all of you back a while back about the outlet cover and seeing that mouse come between the outlet cover and the wall? You can't give him that space. You have to do, we have to do what it takes within us to keep him out. And God says, how you do that is that you resist him. You find ways to plug up that hole. Husbands and wives today have to look at each other and say, hey, you know what? We are going to survive this together. And we're going to take a look at whatever is within our relationship that doesn't belong in our relationship and get rid of it because, why? The adversary is looking for ways to do one thing and one thing only. To destroy. And if he can destroy a marriage, oh, he's on a roll. And if we let him do this, then shame on us because we have God's Holy Spirit. And the same thing applies between you and me as brothers and sisters. If offense has been caused, don't carry that around. Go to your brother. Because, see, we have to teach others in the future how to overcome these things and how to take ownership of your true feelings. Because until we do, we cannot move forward, and we will not be able to teach them how to move forward. Let's take a look at Job. Did Job have a reason to be angry with God? You know the story. Yeah, he had a reason. Job 1. Here is Job, a man who shuns evil. Verse 2. 7 sons, 3 daughters born to him. In his possessions, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yokes of oxen, 500 female donkeys. A very large household. So this man was the greatest of all the people in the East. And his sons would go and feast in their homes, each in their own appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with him, having a party, having a good time. And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send, he would send and sanctify them. He would rise up early in the morning, and he would offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." And so Job went out, made a sacrifice for them, and because of their sins. He loved them that much. Verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of men came and presented themselves before God, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" And so Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth." Okay, we've got these people that are going to be coming up in the resurrection that have been affected by Satan's comings and goings in the earth, causing calamity and tragedies within their lives. How are we going to help them through this? Verse 8, then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" I'm taking a moment to read this, even though we know this, but every time we go back and we read something, do we not find something that we've missed? Do we not learn something else that we didn't learn before? "Have you considered my servant?" Here is God offering his servant Job to be tested, to be tormented by Satan. "There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." Verse 9, Satan answered the Lord and says, "Does Job fear you for nothing? Look, you blessed him. You've given him everything. You put a hedge around his household. This man is not serving you and worshiping you for nothing. You're giving things to him. You're blessing him." But you know, I think it was a little bit deeper than that with Job. "You bless the work of his hand. His possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch forth your hand and touch everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face." The whole purpose here is to get the people to curse God. Not just in a group. Not just in a private setting. He specifically said to God, "Touch everything he has, and he will curse you to your face." That's bold. That just kind of makes me a little queasy all over. And, you know, I stop and I think about Mom. I think about the times when I didn't agree with something that she wanted me to do. Now, to go up to her and curse her to her face? I wouldn't be here today. And if I did, I'd be missing teeth, probably a lip or two. You know, I'd probably be looking rather deformed. Someone would ask, "What happened to him? He cursed his mom." You know, they had this old saying that went around talking about, "Oh, this is so good, make you want to slap your mama." I don't know where you came from. I don't think so. Every time I heard that, I wanted to slap the individual that made the comment. You know, how ridiculous of a statement. If this food was that good, I'm going to go up there and give her a big old hug and kiss and tell her to keep producing this. This is good stuff here. Okay? But Satan is so bold and arrogant that he would just actually tell God, even to God's face, that if he allowed him to touch everything that Job has, that Job would curse you to your face. Now, if that's not a death wish, I don't know what is. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. I'm giving it to you. All right? Game on. You said this is what he's going to do? Well, what do you think God is doing? I mean, what do you think Satan's doing about you and me every day? He's going before God. And he's tattling on us. Why? Because God has called us out of this world. We're his. And so as we begin to understand how Satan works and the things that God allowed to happen, God allows these things to happen for a reason. Now, what was God's reason for allowing Satan to attack Job? Because Satan told God what Job would do. This is what he's going to do. You let me handle this, and I guarantee you, here's what Job's going to do to you. See, this is how arrogant Satan is. And so when I read that article that was printed about Mr. Chambers, I saw the same arrogance that I see here in the adversary in him. So it led me to know who is behind this, who the orchestrator, who the administrator is of this event. And why is this surfacing again? And why are we talking about it? So that we are reminded, family, daily, that there is an adversary out there. And this is just one of many ways that he can get to us. If we let him be that little mouse that's creeping behind that outlet cover plate between the wall, then we're setting ourselves up for failure. And that's not what God wants. And so God allowed Satan to go and to attack everything that Job had. He allowed him to attack the land. Down in verse 13, he allowed him to cause death to come upon his children. Job lost everything but his wife. His wife. You know, most men would probably wonder, well, God, why'd you leave me with her? You took everything else, and why didn't you just take her too? That would be the thought. But, and the reason is, the adversary wants somebody to torment you. Not true. Not true. But yet, God allowed him to touch everything. And so as we read and we know, we understand that Job was very upset. He was angry to see that he had lost all these things. His children, his home, his wealth. Everything was now gone. Now we go over to Job 2. It's not done. In verse 22 of Job 1, in all that was done, Job did not sin nor charge God with anything. Verse 22 of chapter 1, we see that all that had been done, Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with anything wrong. Now we go over to Job 2, and we see that Satan is now allowed to attack Job's health. Okay. Now I kind of bring it down to some of our conditions physically. You know, our health is not the way it should be. Is Satan the orchestrator behind us having bad health? I can't blame all that on Satan. You know, I blame it on ourselves. We know better. We know that we shouldn't be up at 2 o'clock in the morning eating Big Macs and fries. We know better than that. We know that we shouldn't be drinking a gallon of wine after services this evening just to sit back and relax and say, wow, this was a good Sabbath. We know better than that. And Satan's not encouraging us to do these things. These are some things that we do ourselves. This is why, family, we have to own our own true feelings. All right, chapter 2, Satan's health is attacked. Verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job painfully with boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Verse 8, chapter 2, and he took for himself the potsherd with which he scraped himself while he sat in the midst of his ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Man, go ahead, curse God and die. You know, that Verse 9, that last statement in verse 9, why would Mrs. Job tell her husband to do what Satan wanted him to do? Why would she do that? What was her thinking? All right, you as a wife, you as a woman sitting here, you as a sister, you as an auntie, you as a grandmother, why would you think this woman would tell her husband to curse God and go ahead and die? Why would she do that? Do you think that she was being maybe sympathetic to him? I mean, you stop and think, Job was not the only one who lost here. See, all the focus is on Job. But his wife was left with him as well. So the things that Job suffered, his wife suffered right along with him. And sometimes we as men, when we get caught up in our sufferings, we forget about that wife standing right there and what she might be going through and what she might be suffering, because our focus is on who? Me. It's on me. And if Job is sitting around crying, woe is me, and now we see him scraping the boils off of him, and now we see him sitting in the midst of the ashes, you know what I think here? His wife is like, you know what? There's nothing I can say to him. There's nothing else I can do. I'm trying. I'm doing my best. I'm doing my part. But this is the way he wants to be. Well, you know what? If I can kind of switch roles and put myself in the position of the wife, I think I would have probably told Joe to do the same thing. If this is the way you're going to be, then you might as well just go ahead and curse God and die. I think she was being sympathetic. I mean, that's just me. And that's me having years of experience in being a husband, being a man, and watching all of you females. I think here she may have been sympathetic to him, and she wanted to see him out of his misery. I don't think she really wanted to lose her husband, but he is the one also that told her that we cannot do away with God because these things have happened. Okay, she's buying into that. But she's also looking to see what Job is doing about these things. Is he still trusting and believing and having faith in God? You know, maybe he's not walking that walk that he was walking, you know, in chapter 1 when these events took place. And so what we have to do is we have to sit back, lay back in the chair for a moment, and kind of think through this. Why would she tell him to do this? Well, that's what Satan wanted him to do. And so, therefore, I'm just kind of reading into it, and I'm kind of looking at this from a relationship standpoint of view. The time that a wife gets fed up with her husband is because he's not listening, he won't change, he won't do. He just wants to go and just be a royal pain. And she's got to deal with that day in and day out. And, of course, this goes both ways, ladies. You know, we men have to suffer with you too, so it goes both ways. But as a man, what I'm saying is we have to take ownership. We have to take ownership for how we are and what we do. God gave us a mate to be a helper. Verse 10, but he said to her, you speak as a foolish woman speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He did not sin with his lips. There was nothing he said where he had sinned. But something else that we don't see took place for her to tell him to go ahead and curse God and die. Because if he does, what happens to her? What's the rest of the story there? What does she do? She has nothing. They've lost everything. And so she has lost. So, I mean, think about it. We got to think through this as we look at these scriptures and as we read them. Sit back in the chair for a moment and ponder on just this one statement and try to get a glimpse of what's happening and what's going on to understand. Now, verse 11, if Job's life wasn't bad enough, he's got three friends who decided to come along. You know what they did. Here are three guys that don't even understand God working in their lives, but yet they're going to tell Job about what God is doing in his and what he needs to do. And I'm not going to ask you for a show of hand of how many of you have friends like this. You know, they always come around and tell you, you know what you've done. Or they'll remind you of your past. Well, you know that was going to come up to haunt you sooner than later. Yeah, but that was 50 years ago. Well, it's happening to you now. You're going to pay for it. Not knowing what you have gone through, what you've overcome, and how God has been working with you during this time period, they come along and they have all the answers as to what's going on with you. Now let's go over to Job 3. Job 3 begins to change Job's attitude. And when you get over to Job 3, we begin to see and understand that, you know what? Job was angry with God. He was angry with God. In Job 3, he begins to speak out to God openly and curse the day he was born. And then he begins to challenge God about the things that have happened to him. I'm not going to take the time to go down through here and read this, but I'm going to challenge and encourage all of us to read Job 3 and to see how Job speaks out to God and how he talks to God. You know, something's gone wrong. Well, all the things that's happened to him is making him kind of change his attitude. And so in his attitude, he begins to challenge God. Chapter 3, and let's go down to let's go down to verse 21. He says, well, verse 20, why is light given to him who is in misery and life to a bitter soul? Who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures? Who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is the light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged him in? For my sighing comes before I eat. My groaning pours out like water. For the thing I greatly fear has come upon me, and what I dread has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Now, he is speaking to God in a different tone now. Now, if you jump over to Job 10, you will see where now Job wants to file a complaint against God. He literally wants to file a complaint against God. And so he does. Go through chapter 10, and we will see where Job now is like Mr. Chambers. He wants his day in court. He wants legal representation because he doesn't think that he, being a righteous man, should have gone through the trials and the troubles that he has gone through. And so he cries out in his complaint against God. Now, I do want us to take a look at verse 20. Well, let's start in verse 19. He says, I would have been as though I have not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? He's telling God, cease and leave me alone, that I may have a little comfort. You know, God, leave me alone. You know, before I go to the place from which I shall not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, and the land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death, without any order, where even the light is dark. Job, leave me alone. Just let me be. And I'll just go ahead and live my days in darkness. But he's angry with God. And his anger begins to come out. And as we saw in the previous chapter, chapter 10, we saw where Job said he is not going to be silent with God. He's just going to let God know how he feels. And so he does. God, family, understands being angry. But don't sin. And Job was encroaching upon that level of sin. Job 24 and verse 12. The dying grown city and the souls of the womb cries out. Yet God does not charge them with any wrong. Job is going back and he's complaining to God now about the violence and the evil on this earth. And he's challenging God here in verse 24 because there are things that are happening here and yet you've done nothing to those individuals. But yet, verse 13, there are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its ways, nor abide in its paths. The murderer rises up with the light. He kills the poor and the needy. And in the night, he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he disguises his face. In the dark, they break into houses, which they've marked for themselves in the daytime. The thieves come. And Job is presenting these things before God. But yet God, in his argument here, you do nothing to them. Job's 38 and verses 39. Now God reveals his omnipotence to Job, chapter 38. God has sat back and he has listened to Job. He has listened to Job's anger. He has listened to Job's frustrations. Job 38, verse 1. The Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man, God says. Pull your bootstraps up, put the seatbelt on, because now it's my turn. Now I'm going to do some talking. He says, I will question you and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding, God says. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know, you've given me all the answers here before, or stretched a line upon it. Now God begins to challenge Job about the creation. And like a whirlwind, he spun Job around. In chapters 38 and chapter 39, you're going to see God telling Job to answer these questions. Let's take the time and go back and read through all the questions that God asked of Job. And God told Job, I want you to give me an answer. I want you to explain these things to me. And now, Job 40, let's go there. Because chapters 38 through 39, God is asking Job a lot of questions, and he wants Job to answer these questions. Job 40, verse 1. The Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. And so he wants Job to give him an answer. Verse 3, Job responds. Then Job answered the Lord and said, in a very humble way, not arrogant, not challenging. He says, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will not proceed no further. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind again and said, now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Now think about this for a moment. Those who wanted to take God to court, what is the result that they're looking for? Are they trying to justify themselves? Is Mr. Chambers trying to be, you know, this great individual in the world who took God to court and won? What message would that send throughout the land if God allowed that to happen? I don't think God would have any other choice but to just go ahead and destroy the earth and all the inhabitants thereof. except for those that he has called out of this world. He says, so would you condemn me that you may be justified because you don't understand what I'm doing? Or can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and with beauty. God asked Job some very tough questions. He asked him some very tough questions. Job 42. We see here that Job, after God was done with him, asking him to explain a number of different things here, Job is now repentant. Job 42, verse 2. I know that you can do everything, Job says, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. What was God trying to do when he allowed Satan to attack Job? You see, Satan told God that he would cause Job to curse God. Now, God's eyes were on Job, and yet God blessed Job. And God wanted to see if, out of all that he has done for Job, would Job actually do such a thing. God was trying to prove Job. Remember, Job was an upright man. God took knowledge of him, took note of him, was aware of him, and God blessed him. Job says in verse 3, you ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Now, here's a humble man now. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. He says, listen, please, and let me speak. Now, here kind of sets a different tone. Verse 4, he's asking God to please, listen, let me speak. Was he being interrupted? Did God turn away from him? What happened right here? Do we take a look at something like this and wonder, what just happened? What just happened? He says, listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes, they see you. Therefore, I abhor myself, and I repent. I repent in dust and ashes. Here's a repentant heart. This is what God is looking for in you and me. This is what you and I are going to be looking for in those that come up in the resurrection. We're going to hear their story. We're going to know how angry they are. It took us to just do a quick overview of four different chapters here where God did a lot of the questioning of Job. He asked Job a lot of questions. Go back and read, starting in Job 38. Read the questions that God asked Job to give him answers to. What's your method of teaching going to be in the kingdom? Will we have the patience that God had to sit and to listen to all the things that Job had to say? We didn't see much of any interruptions throughout Job's conversations to God, even when he declared his anger to God, even then when he wanted to complain against what God had allowed to be done to him, even when he told God, where is my counsel? You know, Job wanted, you know, he wanted a counsel. He wanted somebody to defend him against God. And yet you're going to see in chapters 30 and 39, there was no counsel for him. And believe me, his friends surely were no counsel for him. So this matter was between Job and God. In our personal lives, as we take ownership so that we can be the leaders, the teachers, the spirit beings that God wants us to be in the future, we have to take ownership for our thoughts, what's in our mind, and what's in our hearts. And we have to stand before God You and me in the privacy of our room, our closet, wherever we take the moment to have that moment with God, we have to have that moment with him and say, okay, you know what? I humble myself before you. And when we get to that point and we have to do that, we should be fasting. We should be fasting, showing our humility before God. Because when we're fasting, our focus is different. Our thoughts are different. And so as we go before God, we go before him with humility, with a repentant heart, asking for his forgiveness. Because this is what you and I are going to be teaching others to do in the future. But we can't teach it, family, if we don't get it today. We have to get and understand this today. Own my anger with God as we move forward and draw ourselves closer to the kingdom of God. We have to own it. And then we have to turn it over to him and let it go. And let it go. And move forward. And let the peace of God dwell within us. We may have to cry. We may have to cry a lot. But what did God tell us? This will only last for a moment. But joy will come in the morning. We have to believe that, and we have to take that to heart. We have to take that to heart. The world is angry with God. There are those that are going to come up in that resurrection that are going to be angry with God because they trusted God. They believed God. Julie Exline said, for the religious folks, our problem is the fact that we won't be honest with ourselves and admit that we're angry with God. In her studies for a decade, in studying a number of people, I found it interesting that when she focused on those Christians who believe in God, they were the most reserved because Christians don't want to admit that. Why? We fear God. We fear what God might say, or we fear what God might do. You know, think about it when you were a parent. How many of you actually just one day just felt like you were Superman or Superwoman and decided you're going to stand up to mom and dad? Oh, this is a day. I'm standing up to them. I bet you didn't probably make it through half the conversation. You know, with me and my mother and my aunt and my grandmother, there's no way in the world. I'd have my track shoes on. I'd get one word out, but I'm going to tell you that door's going to be open before they get to me. I feared them. I feared those two women. And yet I loved them as well. And I honored them. And I respected them. And we have the same honor and respect for God. Anger. Your anger. My anger. Own it. Repent of it. Let it go. And let the peace of God dwell within you. Family, we've got a big work ahead of us. We have a big work ahead of us. We have a lot of work to do. And let that work begin today with me and you.